It's a pleasure to welcome back from Dr. Mark, and Vakasha, it's all yours.
Okay, good. Thank you very much, Rabbi Kalman. Pleasure to be here. Let me begin. Like as always, we'll spend 15 minutes, I think, on catching up. I do want to begin by announcing a big announcement. Those of you who are ready to resume a fairly normal life, Torah in Motion is going in motion, our traveling classroom. We will be going to Morocco, God willing, at the beginning of January. You are all cordially invited. You can go to the website. And I say this, the people listening to us now receive the emails, but many people will be listening later on YouTube. So, like I said, you're cordially invited. Some people I'm looking at have already been with us to Morocco, so they can certainly attest to what a great trip it is.
Yes, it is a great trip, and Mark's a wonderful tour guide, and I forgot to mention that, right? And the early bird special goes till Thursday, but Friday, but we have an extra $350 off per person for tomorrow. And by tomorrow, everything got to them pretty quickly in this environment, but it is a wonderful trip. And now, Baruch Hashem, there's a peace treaty between Morocco and Israel, which adds another nice dimension to the trip. Okay, Baruch Hashem.
And although this is not Torah in Motion, but anyone who's interested can email me. I'm giving my talk on Sunday. I could send the link on the Chazon Ish and Ratzvi Yehuda's letters. I listened to the talk from last week, and you know, it's impossible to speak without to give a whole class like I do, just off the cuff, without misspeaking. I saw that I called the marathoner Rabbi Shubo's granddaughter. It's the great granddaughter. Okay, I want to now. One person in particular, but another person emailed me about the following. So I mentioned it last week. Let me just, I got to pull up here something. Let's get back to this. Yes. Okay. One of you wants to know, maybe more. You know, I've cited Daniel Boyarin many times, because he is a great scholar, but if you know something about him, he's anti-Israel. When I say anti-Israel, I mean like the worst of the worst. BDS compares Israel's actions to literally to Nazi actions. So someone's like, how can I quote him? Well, listen, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on this. Let me just say that scholarship, zelachud v'zelachud. I'm dealing with scholarship here. If your local shul doesn't want to invite him, because that's giving an imprimatur or something, shuls think that, like, believe me, Daniel Boyarin doesn't need your local shul to speak at, but I'm sure he'd like to, because he's part of the community as well. But when you're dealing with scholarship, you don't cancel people, as MIT has learned to its misfortune following that the fiasco in recent days. You don't cancel people because of their views. You know, if he has something to say, and he has something to say about all sorts of things, which is valuable, the fact that his political views are abhorrent, then as far as I'm concerned, that's neither here nor there. And his view, he's in the academic world, so this rarefied world. So, yes, he believes in BDS and all that. You can find interviews with him, but it doesn't really it doesn't affect the real world. If Mark, although I understand he's not comfortable going to show anymore because of things people said to him, I'm not going to weigh in on that. More problematic is this individual, Peter Beinart, because he doesn't consider himself Orthodox, but he goes to an Orthodox show, Daf Yomi, I believe, and all this. Because here you have someone who actually does impact the world. He even encouraged Ben and Jerry's to do what they do. He's constantly pulled out as the Jew speaking against Israel. So I guess that leave that to our rabbis and our shuls to decide what you do with someone whose ideas are really not just ideas. It's not like someone who doesn't believe in the existence of the state of Israel, like a Satmar Chassid, but one who actively fights to destroy the state of Israel as we know it, one state. So, you know, that's a much more tricky thing. What do you do? Does a shul allow? Do you just welcome someone like that? But I'll leave that for the rabbis to discuss. But I just want to answer why Boyarin, because this, I mean, Beinart doesn't do scholarship. He's a political person, so that's his whole life. Boyarin, he does scholarship, and on the side, as it were, he dabbles in those things. I hope that is clear. I thank Malka for replying. I said I've been showing you at least twice, 2 weeks. I showed you the picture of rabbis walking down the aisle, and I said, "Does anyone know of rabbis who still walk down the aisle?" She emails me that at the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, that is the minhag even to this day. And when she got married at SNP, the rabbis walked down the aisle. So I don't know if there's anywhere else other than that. On Shabbos, I had a chance to read again Bernard Drachman's autobiography. I was skimming it. We mentioned him a number of times. And I saw two things I just want to mention to you. One is that on page 222, it's called An Unfailing Light. And in this book, incidentally, he insists that the rabbinical seminary in Breslau, which is the equivalent, I guess, of JTS in Breslau, is Orthodox. And there's many similarities, because although technically it was Orthodox, but yet they allowed teachers there whose views were not Orthodox. So, for example, Gretz, he didn't touch the Torah, but he used to amend Nachalat. Not only did he amend it, when he did Haftorah, when he read the Haftorah, he'd read it with his own emendations. Now, you try doing that in your show, you know, if they're paying attention, they might catch you. But otherwise, you try telling them, "I'm going to read with my emendations." But on page 222, I mentioned that Rabbi Hertz was the first graduate of the seminary. And that's what you find in almost the biographies, the first graduate. But if you look on 222, it says that he was in the first graduating class. Now, maybe there was only one person in this class, but I think it needs further investigation if there were a couple others. And also, if you look in the biographies online, and I did this last week right before the class because I wanted to get the date that he stopped teaching at the seminary. And I saw it said that in 1909, he leaves because he was upset with the direction of the seminary. Yet, if you look in the chapter here, and it's beginning on page chapter 29, that's not what it says. What he describes how they let him go. And he was prepared to continue on with the seminary. I remember I said it's a little strange. 1909 is pretty early. There really isn't a distinction. In the note here, the editor says, well, they probably let him go because he was too Orthodox. But that's not what the text says. It doesn't say that at all. So I take back what I said, that he left, and that there was, it had to do with not being Orthodox enough. Okay, I want to now tell you about, this will be the last thing, I think. Maybe we'll have time for one more, about the Shabbos Tshuva, because I mentioned it, and I promised a few of you. Here's a good book. Tradition and Change, edited by Mordechai Waxman, and it has all the important documents about conservative Judaism. If you look on page 351, you see the famous responsum on the Sabbath that permits driving to shul if you're too far away. This responsum, conservative rabbis will acknowledge it's not halachic. In fact, they assume it's like, even in the tshuva, that it's like a takana they make, that they have no choice. And in the modern era, they did have a choice. They could have adopted a Chabad approach, which you don't tell people it's permissible. They'll just come. But I just want to even just give you an example. Shaul Magid has an article about called Walking Softly On With the Law, Apologetic Thinking in the Orthodox Conservative Debate. This is conservative Judaism from about 20 years ago. And he says explicitly, listen to this. As a conservative Jew, he says, I agree conservative Judaism has been too lenient with its constituency, fearful that too many demands will send them away. In fact, for many conservative Jews, too few demands have sent them to orthodoxy. We have also been too unwilling to revisit mistakes we have made, for example, the driving tshuva. And he goes on, and he speaks about, first of all, how orthodoxy has benefited from the conservative movement. How many Balei Tshuva came from Camp Ramah and conservative synagogues? How many came to orthodoxy as a rebellion against the vacuity of conservative Hebrew schools? I can speak in the first person. I was one of those disaffected Hebrew school refugees and lived as a Haredi and Orthodox Jew for 15 years. And so, I mean, you don't need to be an Orthodox Jew to point out that this was a big problem, this tshuva. In this book, Tradition and Change, there's an article here by Robert Gordas, who was opposed, famous Rabbi Robert Gordas, father, the grandfather of Daniel Gordas, who's written so many interesting stuff. And he points out, correct, conservative Judaism, you have this concept of Catholic Israel, a terrible expression used, invented by Salman Schachter, but you follow, you know, the people. That it's basically the Gemara's idea of Puchazi, go out and see what the people are doing. But what does Gordas say? He says that this doesn't apply if you're dealing with Elisha ben Avuyas or general Sabbath violators. The rabbis, when they said go out and see what the masses are doing, they're not referring to people who are irreligious. Now, but who? So he was very opposed to this response. But who wrote? And there's an article here by Ben Sion Boxer as well. But who wrote this tshuva? This is where it gets interesting. Three rabbis. First is Rabbi Morris Adler. Rabbi Morris Adler is the son of Rabbi Jacob Adler. He was the head of MTJ. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was brought in to make a base medrash. Rabbi Adler is swimming off either Coney Island or Far Rockaway, and he drowns. And when he drowns, then Rabbi Moshe becomes head of the whole place. Think of who this is. This is the son of a Rosh Yeshiva in an MTJ, Rabbi Morris Adler. The next is, this is the name I alluded last week. I said that he's the younger son of, I said he's the older brother of a professor at YU. No one wrote in, so I'll tell you who it is. Turns out he's the younger brother by a year. Jacob Agus. His brother was Irving Agus, professor of Jewish history at YU. Who is Jacob Agus? None other than the Talmud Muvak of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He gets Smicha in the 30s, and he remains two more years to get Yadin Yadin. They were training him. He was a Revels like Wunderkind. He goes to Boston, where he's very close to the Rav. The Rav is his Masada Kedushin. He learns privately with the Rav. He's a rabbi in a shul in Boston. But then in the 1940s, he comes under the influence of Mordechai Kaplan and leaves Orthodoxy. And it's a problem, of course. In Rakefet's book, he doesn't mention Agus by name for some reason, which I don't know. Agus has a distinguished career as an important thinker in the conservative movement. But Rakefet has some quotations of the letter from Revel. He doesn't say who it's referring to. It's Jacob Agus. And as I said, his brother Irving Agus. And the third one also comes from an Orthodox background, Theodore Freeman, who's a rabbi in South Orange, New Jersey. So this gives you a sense of the best and the brightest from the going to the conservative movement. That's the era. One more minute. One of you last class mentioned this individual. So let me clarify. Israel Davidson, who he said was close to Shimon Shkop, and I said because I think he went to Yeshivas Grodno. He did go to Grodno, but he went years before Rav Shimon was the Rosh Yeshiva there. He went to Volozhin also. He was the expert in Hebrew poetry. So I don't know what the connection is to Rav Shimon, but he helped raise a lot of money to him. I have three more things I will save to next week. I just want to say, because I see Susanna's here with us, lo and behold, 2 weeks ago, the day after last week's class, I'm reading this book, The Holocaust and Halacha by Irving Rosenbaum, a traditional rabbi in Chicago. We'll speak about the traditional as soon. And on page 31 and 32, he's speaking about a case where a man accidentally killed a child during the Holocaust. The Nazis were walking around upstairs there in the bunker and smothers the child, trying to keep the child from making a noise. And didn't know. So he approaches Rabbi Shimon Efrati and asked, must he accept upon himself some type of penance through which he might atone for his sin. So you see that Rabbi Rosenbaum is also using the word penance, because I don't know what, it does sound Catholic, but what other word do we have for kapara? Okay, for those who email me, and I'll get to next class about the dispute between the Chafetz Chaim and the Rabbi Shlomo Salanter about apologizing to someone or asking forgiveness if he told Lashon Hara, and he doesn't know about it. I'll get to that whole sugya, because in a volume that just YU just published, believe it or not, they go through the whole thing. But let us return to where we are. Bring my books over here. We continue. Although even today, we're going to do a lot of things that's not Lieberman, because we still need to set the stage. Let's set the stage as to where he's coming to, conservative Judaism, mid-20th century. If you recall, the end of last class, I explained why it was so problematic. We went through the Epstein proposal, which shows the conservative rabbis finally moving off into their own direction halakhically. And I also called attention to the fact that Orthodoxy and conservative on the surface for many people looked very similar. So the rabbis were very worried that people would be led astray. After all, you have conservative synagogues that have machitzas. I gave you some of them. Kilaf Israel, by the way, the synagogue of Louis Finkelstein, I forgot. I looked at my little Lieberman booklet. I mentioned it there. It's another one of these shuls. It's a member of the United Synagogue, so I guess makes a conservative, but it has the women sat in the gallery always. Rabbi Kelman last week mentioned Shara Shamayim in Montreal. Well, lo and behold, when I spoke there once, they gave me this book as a present, The Story of Shara Shamayim. Rabbi Kelman was exactly correct. He said he was like 95% sure that it was a member of the United Synagogue. It absolutely was. Thank you for reminding me of this. Not only was it a member, the rabbis were from the seminary, including Rabbi Shuchat. They opened up a Camp Ramah. You can read about it. It was only in the 70s that they gave their alliance, that they moved in the direction of the Union of Traditional Judaism. There's a whole chapter here, chapter 29, about JT. Yes, so it was a conservative shul, no question about it. With Bima was not in the middle. That was a problem when Rav Kook, they speak about when Rav Kook went to speak there. But it ideologically is a conservative shul, but it functions as an Orthodox shul. I guess that's a shiloh you can ask a post-say. Can you daven in a conservative shul, which for all intents and purposes is an Orthodox shul? But so we spoke about Orthodox shuls that don't have mechitzah, the whole traditional movement, which we're going to get back to, are rabbis, Orthodox rabbis in shuls, mixed seating shuls. I spoke to Zev Elif, Rabbi Zev Elif, because I want, has anything really been written about this? I want to see the literature on it. He says nothing, because I'm going to write about this if I ever get to my book on the Halach History of America. He says, he sent me a one little piece by one of the traditional rabbis, but we do not have a whole history of it, which I'd love to see. And even from a halacha standpoint, this is a complicated thing because, you know, you're going to tell a rabbi not to take the shul. That means you're giving it to the conservative. Then what does that say? Remember, these traditional shuls were Orthodox in everything other than the machitza. That is, the rabbi's ensuring kashrus. He's preaching an Orthodox message. All these things. This is dinei nefashos. So you really need a posek to decide it. And we've spoken about how Rabbi Regensburg believed in keeping the rabbi there. The Rav and others, they were more stringent just for a few years. Because remember, you don't want to give a haskama on approbation either. If the shul's not interested in changing, so it creates all sorts of issues. Today in the Haredi world, confronted with a case like this, they would use that idiotic expression, they have to consult Das Torah. Where do they get this nonsense? You have to consult a posek, a rav. Well, growing up, I never heard this expression, like Das Torah is a person, you consult Das Torah. No, this is a halacha question like any other halacha question. You ask a rav, you ask a shaila, and then you get the answer. Thank you, Nachum Shamaria, because Shamaria Nachum, he sent me something. It's not the exact. He sent me a letter from Rabbi Bogomilsky. If you're from the New Jersey area, you know Rabbi Bogomilsky. He was a rabbi in Newark, right near Maplewood. He writes to the Rebbe because he had an old age home and right next to the shul there, and they would go to his shul, but they came to him and they want to make it conservative. They want to get rid of the machitza or lower the machitza. It's really not clear. Rabbi Teitz urges him to remain there as rabbi, Shachas v'shalom, that it should go to the conservative synagogue. And Rabbi Teitz says he'll be able to raise the machitza, but the Lubavitcher, apparently they were willing to have a machitza here of 4 feet. It doesn't seem so short to me, but in any event, the Rebbe didn't want to give permission for him to be a rabbi there, so, even though the Rebbe told Riskin that that's okay for him to take the synagogue. I guess it depends. If you speak to a Chabadnik, it's different. One more synagogue. This is interesting. If any of you are from Massachusetts, Springfield, Massachusetts, Congregation Kadima, doesn't exist anymore. They merged 3 synagogues in Springfield, Massachusetts. Springfield, Massachusetts, that's where the NBA Hall of Fame is. If you ever travel there, there used to be 3 different shuls. Now there's 1 shul. They've all merged. Congregation Kadima, an Orthodox shul, always an Orthodox shul with a machitza, and the rabbi there for 20 years was none other than Rav Isaac Klein. He was rabbi there till 53, as I recall. I'm not sure if it's his successor or there was one for a short time before between that, but I have to determine this, but Rabbi Kelman writes in Rabbi Norman Lamb. I think he was actually the successor, but maybe there was someone there for a year or two between. So here, the same synagogue. First, they have Rabbi Isaac Klein, who was a great London. And then you have Norman Lamb in the same synagogue. So the fact that Isaac Klein came from the seminary, he goes to Orthodox synagogue. In the 30s, it wasn't an issue. By the way, Isaac Klein is, I wouldn't say he's unique because there's two other people. He is one of three people to receive private smicha from Louis Ginsburg. Louis Ginsburg only gave it to three people he thought were not just the typical JTS graduates, but like Imuyim, who could really paskin shilas. One was Isaac Klein, the other was Finkelstein, and the third was Boaz Cohen. So this era, I'm going to give you some statistics here, which might shock you, especially the young generation, because we all know an Orthodox shul is, we know what a conservative shul is. I'm going to give you even a later period, 1961, because that's where Jonathan Sarna has the statistics in an article he wrote. Jonathan Sarna quotes a source that in 1961, there were perhaps, quote, 250 Orthodox synagogues with family seating. That is, synagogues that belong to the OU, otherwise identified as Orthodox, with mixed seating. A different estimate from 1954 holds that, listen to this, 90% of the graduates of Skokie, actually in those days it wasn't Skokie, it was in Chicago, that is Hebrew Theological College, and 50% of the graduates of Reitz took positions where family seating or optional family seating. Optional family seating is you had certain synagogues, even conservative synagogues you had, where in the middle it was men and women together, and on the sides or on one side, you would have separate seating. In 1954, Jacob Agus, Rabbi Jacob Agus, the person we just mentioned here before, he claimed that 50% of the members of the RCA served in synagogues, also with family seating. Now, the RCA disputed this, but they refused to provide an alternate percentage. In other words, they denied it, but they would not give the answer. Because it doesn't look so good if you say, well, it's not 50%, it's 46%. It doesn't look so good either. I want to get into the RCA archives because they have all sorts of good stuff there. I know that because I have some of the stuff, but someone on the inside told me, don't hold your breath. He doesn't think they'll let any historians in because there's things today that the RCA is embarrassed about of what was done, what was accepted. So let's hope I get entree. I have to get protection. In 1966, I found this in Hapardes, Rabbi Simcha Elberg, the editor of Hapardes, claimed that most OU synagogues had family seating, which is an exaggeration. But the fact that he would say that, and then this becomes an issue because the Agudas Rabbonim are saying that you can't trust the OU Hashkacha, because how can you trust Hashkacha, which is allowing mixed seating? When I wrote My Soul, Lieberman and the Orthodox, published in 1906, there was only one family seating congregation in America that was a member of the OU. There had been another one until recently that was Beth Tefila in Baltimore. The rabbi there was Samuel Rosenblatt. That's the Enoch, the grandson of Yossel Rosenblatt. But that had put in separate seating. That put in Mechitza. That show was Denver. Beis Medrash HaGadol, Beis Joseph of Denver. It is no one, and not only that, it had a rabbi, or YU guy became the rabbi there with the approval of his Rosh Hashiva YU. And ironically, I was told that he couldn't be a member of the CRC, like rabbis in Detroit, Denver usually are, because he had a mixed seating shul. And they only grandfather people in. They don't allow you a chachilah. So even though I didn't confirm it with this rabbi, but I was told that even though he got a heter from his Rosh Hashiva, nevertheless, they wouldn't let him in. Now, this shul in Denver is no longer a member of the OU. I want to show you what's on the website. I went to the website earlier today. Here it is. Beis Medrash HaGadol Beit Yosef is a unique independent congregation serving a diverse membership. et cetera, et cetera. Our community includes a vibrant morning and evening service every day of the year with a mechitza, a family singing experience on Shabbat and holidays. So during, and by the way, on Shabbos, you could, they have two minyan. But during the week, it's mechitza, and on Shabbos, you can have that option. And then they have over here, if you go to their services. I don't understand this. It says here, traditional Friday night services, temporarily suspended. Friday night, they usually have modern Orthodox, that's mechitza. We will recommence these in spring 2022. What kind of insanity is this? No davening until spring 2022? But look at the hair, sanctuary. We provide sacred space for those who wish to learn, sing, reflect, pray, and connect to God, but prefer to sit together. That's in the main sanctuary, sacred space. The Rav would say it's not sacred, it's Christianization, but okay. Shari Simcha, in our chapel, our synagogue offers a lay-led modern Orthodox service. In this service, we adhere to the halachic tradition of separate seating for men and women. So here you see that it's very unusual that you have a shul that has both of this. But this is an Orthodox shul. It always was an Orthodox shul, which would allow there be a place for men to sit separately, women to separately, but always had family seating. But as the 1950s, 60s, 70s, by the time you get to the turn of the millennium, they're really going extinct, these shuls, and the ones that exist are no longer feel comfortable in the OU. So they separate from the OU. They might have been given a warning that they have to put a mechitza in all of the minyanim by a certain date or not. I don't know. But this still continued until the 21st century. Yeah. Incidentally, there was a rabbi in Kansas City, later in Miami Beach. I spoke to him a couple times. His name was Rabbi Tibor Stern. Shmuel Tuvia Stern. He's a Lamdan. Make no mistake about it. He gave the Hashkacha to Hebrew National before the Triangle K. And I once asked him, is your Hashkacha just for the conservative Jews, or is it even for Bali Yeshiva Bachrim and Bali Torah? And he was very upset with the question. He says it's for everyone. But he was a big Lamdan from Hungary. He was in Mexico before that, wrote a number of volumes of Tshuvot. The fact that he was a big Lamdan doesn't mean his Hashkacha is good. I can't speak to his Hashkacha one way or the other, but I can tell you he's a big Lamdan. And I can also tell you there have been plenty of big Lamdanim whose Hashkachas were never accepted. In Boston, there was not just a Lamdan, there was a Gon Olam in Boston, and yet no one held of his Hashkacha. I'm talking about Rabbi Savitsky, a Gon of Gonim. So whether people don't hold of it because they're wrong, or there's rumors. We spoke about the Rabbi Robach situation, or whether there are reasons. You could be a great Talmid Chacham and maybe not on top of everything. I'm not going to get into it. I don't know. But Rabbi Stern, there's a tshuva of him from Rav Moshe Feinstein to him in Yibros Moshe. It's in volume one, Orach Chaim number 41. He addresses him as Harava Gaon. You know, I mean, like I said, he's a real Lamdan. But you see in this tshuva that Rabbi Stern tried to, we don't know the context. I think the context is, though, you know, is we don't have the question to Rabbi Stern. We don't even have his tshuva. He didn't publish in his sefer. He sent it to Rav Moshe. I think it's obvious he's trying to provide a halachic justification for traditional minyanim. And what he argued is that although you need separation of men and women, that's like it had in the Beis Hamikdash and at other events when you could have inappropriate mingling. That's the whole point. The whole point of the mechitza is not to see, at least according to the standard understanding. It's so they don't physically mingle. There is a shita, the Satmar shita in Germany, and in Hungary also this was a shita. But in Lithuania and other places, and today in America, unless you're in a Hasidic community, you go by, the problem is there's the two lashonos in the Rambam. Is it to see or to mingle? But we assume it's to mingle. So you can see the women, you just can't be in a way that you can mingle. Rabbi Stern wanted to say that during davening, because you're focused on the davening, we're not concerned with Kalos Rosh, and therefore there shouldn't be a problem sitting mixed seating. So Rav Moshe says, let me read you what Rav Moshe says. Umasha ratza kavod torato l'chadesh t'bishat ha-tfilah. Odif, you wanted to say, Rabbi Stern, that davening is better when it comes to mixed being together with women and men. Shein lachush kol, you don't have to be concerned with it at all. Ein lachush kol kalos rosh. You don't need to be concerned about kalos rosh. Ein kan isser me'ravin zebizah. And there's no isser to daven, men and women, because you're focusing on the davening. Ve'in kain ein sarach al mechitza kol. And therefore, you don't need a machitza at all. That was Rabbi Stern's argument. V'od yoter, shalafize yochlu leishev mamash moravim. And therefore, according to you, Rabbi Stern, men and women can sit right next to each other. Basically, he's offering halachic justification, not like a Rabbi Regensburg, just for the rabbi, but for the people davening as well, that this is okay. What does Ramosha say? Hinei chas v'shalom lomar kein. Ramosha says, God forbid to say this. V'sharei mare, quote Tarto, and that expression, sharei mare, appears in the Gemara about Rabbi Hillel, not Hillel, the Rabbi Hillel, the one who comes later, the Amora we spoke about in last semester, where he says there's no Mashiach. Because during the time of Chizkiel, they enjoyed it. What did they reply to him? May God forgive him. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says to Rav Stern, God should forgive you for such a position that you don't need a machitza. It's one thing to say, well, let the rabbi go in because we want to save the shul. But to make an argument that halachically you don't need a machitza, he didn't go for it. I told you already also that there were some synagogues that had separate seating without a machitza. But it was quite rare. I want to show you, though, a picture, and I thank one of our listeners for sending this to me. I'll identify him in my next blog post where I'm going to put all those pictures up there. But I want to show you a picture now of the Unterberg Auditorium at the Jewish Theological Seminary, which Lieberman davened in. So we know that Lieberman is exacting in halacha. He obviously thought that this was acceptable. Maybe not ochilah, the best thing, but if this is what you have, and that's, you know, it's not a Christianization of a synagogue. It's not forbidden. We'll see even later what Louis Ginsburg says about mixed seating. It's separate seating, which is not the best, but under certain circumstances, if that's all you have, obviously Ben felt it was permissible. Because he felt he had to daven at the seminary. So I'm going to show you a picture now. Let me show you two pictures. Here you see it, the first one. This is Hoshana Rabbah. The first person you see there is Moshe Tzucker. He was a big scholar in Judeo-Arabic, Rav Sadia Gold. Right behind him is Lieberman. And Heschel is over here, the fourth one. There's Gerson Cohen, if you see my thing there. And that is, I believe, Israel Frankis. I'll show you his picture in a minute. And here's another, I'll show you another picture where you see the woman, and maybe you, one of you could identify who this woman is. And so you see, that's the Unterberg Auditorium, where you had men and women not sitting together, but no machitza. Is that halachically acceptable? I have no doubt Lieberman would say it's obviously not the best thing, but under those circumstances, he felt it was okay. And again, if you're sitting in the middle, if you're not sitting at the end, then that's sort of like a large separation, could be a machitza also. Whether you can daven there, ask your local rav, but that's, I don't know when this minyan began. There's no question that in the early years of the seminary, they had separate seating with a gallery or a machitza, whatever they had. But that's why it's there. Here's Israel Frankis. He's like the only one from that generation who's still alive. Here he is. Regarding the machitza, I want to read to you what Louis Ginsburg says. David Glinken, Rabbi David Glinken of the Schechter Seminary in Israel, who's written a good deal about the conservative halakha, he edited this very nice book, The Response of Louis Ginsburg. And you see, beginning on page 85, you see that Ginsburg is also very, he doesn't see it as halacha, but a Jewish custom was well established for 2,000 years. He says mixed pews would rob the synagogue of its democratic character and transfer the snobbishness of the home to the house of God. He is very, he says anyone who thinks that separate seating is something negative about women doesn't know what they're talking about. He is very, these first letters are from the 20s, and he's really strong that you need to have separate seating. You can't have mixed seating. He says, he who maintains, this is from 47 even, he who maintains that the separation of sexes in the synagogue is nothing but the expression of the Oriental concept considering the inferiority of women shows impartial ignorance of Jewish as well as Oriental history. However, what Ginsburg, Golinkin also provides here a letter in which a rabbi writes to Ginsburg to say that 85% of the community wants to have mixed seating. If we don't compromise with them, what are we going to do? We can't, it's going to, the synagogue is going to fall apart, basically. And in 1947, December, Ginsburg writes, if the conditions are such that it will create a real danger, spiritual welfare, then he's willing to allow it. But he doesn't like it. He's not happy. He sees it as like a shas hadchak. So we see that in the conservative movement, they never actually permitted it as a lechachila. Later, of course, it's a lechachila. Other than a few of those shuls in Toronto, which had, well, I don't know if they still have separate seating there. They're not egalitarian. But the idea, as it was once explained to me by a conservative rabbi, the idea that there's anything wrong with a machitza or there's anything wrong with non-egalitarian, that was never part of conservative Judaism. Today, of course, if you say that you're not egalitarian, you can't be conservative. By definition, you're going against their principles. And I dare say it's the same thing with machitza, although it never was that originally. They were offering what they thought were kulas. But no one ever said there's anything wrong with a machitza. Today, of course, they'll give all the reasons that the twaddle that Ginsburg says that you say this, you know, it's degrading to women, which this idea that you separate the men and the women. But today, in the conservative movement, that's like an ikari ikarim, that any such separation. In fact, they've even, for many of them, even the woman has to wear a yarmulke or it's a problem. Someone told me, it's hard for me to believe it, but someone told me that he was at a conservative synagogue. Maybe he didn't know, because I can't believe this. But he said that they wanted the women to wear kippot. I mean, so, we're not dealing with 21st century. We're dealing with classic conservative Judaism. Let us continue. I want to offer one more example. Which I forgot to say, where Gurak, because I see I have a note here, Gurak in one of his books mentions it, of this evidence of how in the early years, it's hard to know the difference, Orthodox and conservative. The Young Israel of Brooklyn, founded in 1918, this is the Young Israel, was a member of the United Synagogue until 1929. This is Young Israel. Young Israel, which for machitzas, for them, that was the absolute. You needed a machitza. They didn't like rabbis. The early Young Israel didn't want rabbis. But they always insisted on machitzas. And then if you look in my Lieberman booklet, you'll see I have a quotation there from Rabbi David de Sola Poole of the Spanish and Portuguese Synagogue, where he says, he's speaking about how orthodoxy has changed in America. And he says, innovations like the late Friday night service or the removal of the women's gallery or the confirmation of girls or a community Seder celebration on Pesach Reve would have shocked the worshippers a generation ago. Today, such practices are accepted in numerous congregations. He calls it a distinctively American standard of orthodoxy. So here he's, the late Friday night service, that's also a problem, but removal of the women's gallery. He doesn't say if this means mixed seating or just separate seating without a mechitza, but I think he means mixed seating. He's talking about how he's making his peace with it. Now, during this period we're speaking about, the tension between the seminary and conservative Judaism and Orthodoxy is highlighted by the fact that, increased by the fact that many of the, what we call the best and the brightest, the most talented members of Orthodoxy were choosing to go to the seminary. I mentioned last class, David Feldman. When I asked him why he went to the seminary, he already had an Orthodox smicha, a private smicha from Brooklyn, some rabbi in Brooklyn. He told me that we thought that was the future. In a survey, listen to this, in a survey of applicants to the JTS Rabbinical School covering the years 46 to 57, 60% came from Orthodox homes and 30% were graduates of Yeshiva College. So 30% of the people going into the seminary smicha program were from YU, Yeshiva College. Then it becomes Yeshiva University. I don't think if you took the last 10 years, even the last 20 years, we have someone who I know who could find out the answer to this because his son-in-law is involved in the program. I would be shocked if there was even one graduate of Yeshiva College in the last 20 years who went for smicha at the seminary. And there's no reason to think that the numbers were any different in the 30s. We have a constant movement away from orthodoxy to conservatism with no appreciable gains in the other direction. It's not like today where they're coming in the other direction. Nothing. The Orthodox therefore see conservative Judaism as a real threat to its survival, and most observers believe that orthodoxy is on its way out. Marshall Sklar, the famous statement he made in his book on one of his books on American Jewish sociology, that orthodoxy is, quote, a case study in institutional decay. Everyone in the 50s knew that the future was the conservative movement, the suburbs, etc. And as such, as we said, that's why it's such a shock when Lieberman comes to the seminary. Yeah, I mentioned Lieberman is appointed professor of Palestinian institutions, and I forgot the exact title, this fancy title, because he's an expert in Yerushalmi. But Ginsberg was also an expert in the Yerushalmi. I have here, this is great. This book is worth a lot of money, because it'll never be reprinted. And I have three of the four volumes. This is the commentary of Ginsberg on the Yerushalmi. The last volume, the fourth volume, was edited by Halivni. You can see the English, here it is. It has an English title page, has a very nice introduction in English also. Where did I get this from? Because this is published 1941. The last volume, which is edited by Halivni, I don't remember the year. I'll see right now. Where did I get it? Believe it or not, Hebrew College. When I was living in Boston, I just put up a PDF in 1961. That's when they published the other volume, the last volume. Hebrew College was getting rid of some of their books. They're having a book sale. I got this for a steal. I don't know what it was, $15 or something. I guess they figured, who wants this? I'm sure this is quite expensive. It was more expensive, I think, years ago, because now it's as a PDF of it. I guess, and anyone who's interested, I have PDFs of the four volumes. Where do they get the PDFs from? Because they put them on HebrewBooks.org about 15 years ago. And as soon as it went up, I knew that, 2009, I think it was, so not less. As soon as it went up, I knew that this was going to be taken down within a matter of days, because someone's going to tell the owner of it, Rosenberg, that it's conservative, Ginsberg. So I immediately made PDFs, and I have PDFs. I did that with a number of books, that the non-kosher books that they took down. If you go to Otzar HaChachma, this is non-Otzar HaChachma, you have all of Lieberman's stuff on Otzar HaChachma, because he's Orthodox. Ginsberg is not Orthodox. No one would ever claim Ginsberg is Orthodox, although it's an important, a very good work. Yaakov Weinberg cites this and other Gedolim as well. So it's not Otzar HaChachma. Otzar HaChachma is a good, you could do a sociological study of Otzar HaChachma. Otzar HaChachma is that online database which has the best search engine, and it has all the Sfarim. It probably has about 100,000 Sfarim. It's incredible. It's revamped how you learn, because everything's at your fingertips. But you can do a sociological study of what's regarded as Orthodox, because they're in the Haredi world and they only include things that are, quote, Orthodox. So like a book by, well, I don't know. I don't want to get into particulars. Some are in, some are not. But I already told you how Perush of Yehuda Chassid, the complete version, including his biblical criticism, that's now on Otzar HaChachma. It used to not be. So they've paskined, and they have a Rav who decides what's kosher and what's not, that they can include that. There was another Rav, though. I should mention this, because when Lieberman comes on the scene, another Rav had recently passed away who was a great expert in Yerushalmi. Today there's a Dafyomi in Yerushalmi. People were interested in it, but no one really learned Yerushalmi. It was this arcane stuff. I'm going to show you a very interesting video. There was a rabbi in Pittsburgh. His name was Shimon Moshe Zivitz. He wrote a two-volume commentary on Yerushalmi. So why am I mentioning him? Because there is a video of him. Warner Brothers. His son was connected to Warner Brothers. And one of Warner Brothers' first silent movies was made of Rabbi Zivitz. I'll show it to you, just a minute or two of it. Now, many of you are going to be thinking, as you look at it, look at the rabbi and look at his children. It shows what America did. You know, the big Talmud Chacham, the Rav of Pittsburgh. He was the Rav of Pittsburgh. And look at his children. And it's true that you can take every one of these rabbis from the 20s and 30s with the long beard and Talmud Chacham, and if you have Shomer Shabbos descendants, it's almost a miracle here. But it's not America. The same thing in Europe. You've all seen pictures, I'm sure, where you have the old grandfather with the beard and the woman covered her hair with the shado or the tichel or whatever. And then you look at the children and the grandchildren. That was the 20th century. It was the 19th century also. That's just the era. But here, let me show you this. There's no sound, but I think you'll get a kick out of this, Rabbi Sivitz. And here he is. Let me enlarge it so you can see it very nicely. Play it for a minute. So that is Rabbi Sivitz with his children. There's a whole description here. Some of the first footage from the Warner Brothers, whose other partner was Sivitz. So Sivitz, who's, I believe that was his son, not his nephew, but I believe was the partner with Warner Brothers. They made this movie. And you see the children not following in the father's path of becoming Talmidei Chachamim. But okay, they're becoming businessmen and things like that. But it's not America. Yeah, the same exact thing in Europe. So much so that Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, he comes to America, he's here in 1938 into 1939, he says that religious life is better in America than in Poland. That's what Rabbi Chanan said. He said it's worse in Poland. I'm not sure exactly what he meant, because he speaks about the Kavod HaTorah, wherever he went, how the people came to hear him speak. And his impressions were that Jewish life was worse in Poland. In other words, Jewish life in Poland was on its way down, was bad and on its way down, and he thought America had a future, and he thought at that moment in time, Jewish life was better in America. Okay, so Lieberman, as we said, he comes from the seminary, to the seminary from Harry Fischel, an Orthodox Jew. He immediately devotes himself to scholarship. That's his idea. He's not focusing on religious developments in the conservative movement, anything like that. But that's not lessen the blow, the Orthodox world, as we'll see. Aaron Pechenik, there was a leading Mizrahi figure named Aaron Pechenik, and he wrote an article, and he reports that Yaakov Levinson, was a rabbi in New York, a leading Mizrahi rabbi. He wrote a volume of Tshuvot as well, and essays, that he reports that Yaakov Levinson asked Pechenik to organize a meeting of the leaders of Mizrahi in New York and the Gudas Rabbanim to discuss Lieberman's coming to the seminary. They have to do something. And according to Pechenik, or Meir Bar Ilan is the father-in-law of Lieberman, was in New York at the time, and he explained to the Gudas Rabbanim and the Mizrahi that he was opposed to what Lieberman did. He shouldn't have come. But that his son-in-law felt he had no choice. He simply did not have financial security in the land of Israel, so that he could not devote himself to scholarship. Now, it's true that when he comes to the seminary, he has a relaxed workload and he's given a good salary. And this is the reason later Pechenik himself reports that Lieberman told him the reason he came and remained at the seminary was financially, he was able to, they gave him a salary and he had time to do his research. In addition, in one of Lieberman's letters to Ginsberg before he came to the seminary, what sticks out is his desire to work in an environment conducive to scholarship. Yet it's possible that monetary concerns and the desire to work in an environment conducive to scholarship are not the only reasons Lieberman chose to come or remain at the seminary. I already told you last class, I think it was, that he also gave in his letter to Finkelstein, he speaks about how happy he is to be able to teach Torah. And it was claimed by no less than Lieberman's Haredi brother, Rav Meir Lieberman, one of you emailed me, or one of the people who watches on YouTube, that he was to the right of Ada Haridit. Okay. But he explained that Lieberman went to the seminary to teach Torah, which is exactly what the sense you get from his letter to Finkelstein. In line with this, Yaakov Herzog's widow, Penina Herzog, recalls, and remember, Yaakov Herzog is the best friend of Shaul Lieberman, and Yaakov Herzog was also very close to him. She recalls that Lieberman told her that he, quote, regarded, quote, as his task to train American Jews to make a commitment to study and observe the mitzvot. So Lieberman also sees himself as involved in a religious mission. In a letter to Gershom Scholem, shortly after he arrived in the U.S., he writes that he understands the psychology of the seminary students, quote, it appears that with a proper approach, it's possible to draw them nearer to Torah and Judaism. Lieberman is writing this to Scholem. Scholem is a completely irreligious Jew. The fact that Lieberman, in writing to Scholem, who is a good friend of his, had been writing about scholarship, but that he would choose to tell Scholem, of all people, that Lieberman feels that he could bring the American Jews close to Torah and mitzvos, to Torah and Judaism, when Scholem himself doesn't care about Torah and Torah. He cares about Judaism, I guess, of a sort. He doesn't care about Torah. It shows that Lieberman thought this was very important. Whatever, though, the primary reason for him going and remaining at the seminary, although I speculate that when he was in Israel, he probably didn't realize really the extent of the machlokes. He did, between Orthodox and Surav, he did know that there was an issue with the seminary in the Orthodox world. If not to the extent, he certainly knew, because we will see very clearly the Shiloh he asked when he was in Jerusalem. And it's possible that Lieberman was himself conflicted about this throughout his life. And I don't think this is a judgment Lieberman would have rejected. I say this because I found Lieberman wrote himself, quote, one should not, this is a letter Lieberman said to Rav Yechezkel Abramsky's son, Yaakov Dov. Everyone knows Yechezkel Abramsky had a son named Shimon Abramsky, who was irreligious. And but he also had another son, the writer, Yaakov David Abramsky. Lieberman writes to him, quote, one should not search for shleimut, completeness, not in people and not in the world. Someone who appears complete without inner contradictions, one must examine whether he is even alive. So Lieberman recognizes that there's inner stirot, contradictions. Lieberman arrives, and yet the Agudas Rabbanim does not make any public comment. They just have this private intercession, as it were, with his father-in-law. Yet 5 years after his arrival, the year 1945, Agudas Rabbanim in those days was the most important organization. Also was hugely involved in Hatzalah. That's where all the old Rabbanim from Europe were. It was a very powerful organization. It obviously dies out as the Yiddish-speaking rabbis give way to the American rabbis. Now, they could have remained a Agudas Rabbanim. The problem is they made a fatal error. They refused to accept yeshivas or Bitzal Chanan graduates because they said, what do these guys know? We're going to let them in? We've been in yeshivas, the great yeshivas in Europe, where they weren't, 15 years, and these guys go to college and this. So they didn't want to let these American rabbis in because they thought they weren't learned enough. But as the American population, the new generation comes, these older rabbis, they're left to barely eke out a living with hashkachas, because what shul is going to have a rabbi who can barely speak English or doesn't understand the American scene? Although Agudas Rabbanim didn't make any comments when he first came, they felt it could no longer remain standing 5 years later. And that's because what precipitated the action, and we're going to focus on this next class, and I have a new discovery. I publicized this discovery, but I think most people's minds, they don't know about this, so it's good to repeat it again. What precipitated the action was the rising controversy about Mordechai Kaplan. Now, Mordechai Kaplan's views were well known, and he had been teaching at the seminary for many years, and that's an issue we'll also get into. How could the seminary have someone there teaching whose ideology is completely at odds to what conservative Judaism teaches, although Kaplan is identified as a conservative Jew? Reconstructionism only comes in a little bit later. The movement. I mean, Reconstructionism is he's a conservative Jew, identified as a conservative Jew, advocating his philosophy of Reconstructionism. The two were tied together at first, conservative and Reconstruction. How could Mordechai Kaplan teaching at the seminary? We'll see the implications of this. From Finkelstein's standpoint, the seminary is an academic institution, and you're not having Mordechai Kaplan teach Tanakh. You're not having him teach Gemara. You're having him teach certain areas that are not going to be problematic. But you never would have this at a yeshiva. So it was always a problem having Kaplan there. There never could be a merger between YU and them. But matters reach ahead in 1945 when the Reconstructionist Foundation publishes a Sabbath prayer book co-edited by Kaplan. And here it's stated, among other heresies, quote, "The Torah is a human document and not one supernaturally inspired." In response to this, and I'll show you the article next class, and I'll talk about the controversy. But in response to this, Agudas Rabbanim excommunicated Kaplan. We'll read the Cherem next class. And the Cherem explains why they have to excommunicate Kaplan. After all, there's a lot of Reform rabbis on excommunicating. But they say we have to excommunicate Kaplan because he's a conservative Jew. And people think that conservative Judaism is like Orthodoxy. There's not much of a difference. So therefore, we have to show that there is a difference. So not only do they excommunicate Kaplan, there is a public burning of the prayer book. And one of the Agudas Rabbanim leaders, Yisrael Rosenberg, proclaims that Kaplan is even worse than the reformers. What we'll do next class is first I'll talk about the burning. Contrary to what everyone says, this was not an Agudas Rabbanim action. I was zocha fortunate to uncover the true story of the burning, which I wrote on the Sfarim blog, but if you forgot about it, I'll repeat it and we'll preserve it for posterity here. Then we will move into the Kaplan dispute there. And that leads Agudas Rabbanim to turn to Libran with an open letter. Reb Shaul, Hagaon, they call him, Reb Shaul. How can you be at an institution with Mordechai Kaplan? They even say, we heard that he treats him like he's under Cherem. And I'll give you the evidence that Lieberman, at least Kaplan thought so. I'll give you the evidence from the diary next week. That Lieberman, it seems, treated Kaplan like he was under Cherem, that is, Lieberman held to the Cherem. So I'll give you all that details next class. We will, let me mark it where we ended here. Covered some good ground today. Rabbi Kelman asked me how many more classes. 2 classes ago, I think I said 5 or 6, maybe now 5 or 6. We have lots of good stuff. I don't want to cut it short.
I didn't believe you when he told me 5 or 6. I knew not to believe you.
Okay, but I can promise you one thing. I don't have to say believe you. There won't be 53. Maybe 15, but whatever. It's all is good. Whatever my Tarfon say, the work is not for us to complete. So let me look at the questions here and the comments. Binary teaches NYU. Doesn't that mean new scholarship? I think you mean Boyarin, Binar teaches at NYU. He teaches journalism, yeah, but that's just a side gig. A lot of these people teach a class. His main thing is he's an opinion maker. He had his Jewish currents. He's not just an opinion maker. He's trying to create facts on the ground. So if you're a supporter of Israel, then Peter Beinart is an enemy, a public enemy. I mean, he's not just Boyarin in the ivory tower speaking about how bad Israel is. Beinart is actually. So well, what do you do if you're a shul there? I strongly believe that everyone's children should be allowed to go to school, although the Satmar kicked out this guy in Vienna. Because he went to the Iranian conference, the Holocaust Denial Conference, and Satmar doesn't like these crazy Tori Karta. I mean, they could be crazy, but not that crazy. And at the end of the day, Satmar doesn't believe in the existence of the state, but they don't work to destroy it. Their attitude is when the Mashiach comes, there won't be a state. Okay, so that's, but you have a shul? I don't know. I don't know what a modern Orthodox shul would do if you have someone who actively is engaged in undermining and subverting the state of Israel, especially since in the modern Orthodox world, the state of Israel is so important. But even the Haredis, they don't care so much about the state in the theological sense, but they certainly are big supporters of Israel's security. So, and someone says Beinart's problematic is influential beyond the theory ground. He gives cover to Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. So it's very different than, but if Beinart writes an interesting book, of course I'll quote it. If it has a factual book, why not? And yes, Mel says teaching doesn't necessarily mean doing scholarship. Michael says they both advocate the destruction of Israel and the Neville murder of Jews. They're well beyond the pale. So Boyarin should not be given any platform. Would we quote the scholarship of a Ku Klux Klan member and conveniently ignore his repugnant views on race? I have to say, I hate to disappoint you, Michael. Yes, I would quote a Ku Klux Klan member. If a Ku Klux Klan member writes a wonderful study about Rembrandt's paintings, of course I'd quote it. What does one thing have to do with the other? Unless you show me that there's a connection. If you can show that there's a connection, that's the old dispute about Heidegger. If you can show me that Heidegger's philosophy is inherently connected or that Wagner's music is connected to the anti-Semitism, okay, that's one thing. But it could be you have two separate areas. We had a professor at University of Scranton, the very first Holocaust denier in America. His name was App, APP, was a professor of English at the University of Scranton. That's our claim to fame. So if this guy App happened to write a good book, maybe on T.S. Eliot, I don't know. I'm not going to boycott the book. That's just, what can I say? That's Barry Hartman, Rabbi Barry Hartman. Rabbi Joseph Telushkin is a great nephew of Rabbi Joseph Adler of MTJ. Telushkin is named for him. It's Joseph Adler, not Jacob. You're right. I did not know that. Thank you very much. And Rabbi Adler supported Helen Telushkin, his niece, at CCNY. I did not know that. New things I learn each class. Ugh. Rabbi Shudnow. It's too much to read, but he quotes that Rabbi Gordas told us in class that he and two other rabbis are the ones who presented the Shabbat Shalom to the committee. Dr. Gordas emphatically said that this was a grave mistake. He said it did not help the conservative movement and synagogues in any way. He said that no Jews became better synagogue participants due to the decision. Additionally, he pointed out neither he nor the other two rabbis of the Meridrov, even though they presented this for approval by the committee. Well, and it achieved, I'll give you the numbers here. The Shabbos tshuva, the way the conservative movement works is that you can have a decision, a majority decision, therefore a minority, and they're all considered, could be considered options. But the this was the majority. Does it give the number here? No. It has no official status. It remains the opinion of a group of men because the rabbinical assembly doesn't give approval unless it's unanimously approved. But this was the majority opinion. I don't know what you mean, though, Rabbi should know that. It was not voted upon. It wasn't officially voted upon to make it a policy, but it secured the support of the majority of the law committee. I don't know what you mean by Rabbi Gordas presented it, unless the people who wrote it gave it to him and he has to submit it. Rabbi Kalman says, well, the Rav was very machmir in public. It is well known that on more than one occasion the Rav told rabbis to accept jobs and non-mechitza shuls. I mentioned that two semesters ago, I think it was. Rav Schechter reports it, where they come to him, he says, well, first of all, I said, if you want to have, we're talking about just Rosh Hashanah jobs, if you want to have it in non-mechitza shuls, I won't give you a hetter, but you can go to, it's okay to go to another rabbi. What you're speaking about is the Rav told many people to accept jobs, not just Rosh Hashanah gigs to make money, but jobs in non-mechitza shuls, Rabbi Belkin, and not just that, they did other yeshivas as well. But the Rav was supposed to be for a few years, not as a permanent thing, not to give and in the work, Haredi, they would not do that at all. Baruch says Rabbi Telushkin today holds the pulpit in a non-Orthodox synagogue for the performing arts in the Los Angeles area. Yes, that's true. Rabbi Shunna says traditional synagogues were the Orthodox shuls with mixed seating. Exactly, we spoke about that, yes. Denver, Bina says pressing Denver's catering has OU Hashkacha. Maybe you mean the shul there, okay. And Rabbi Yellen says the Rabbi BMH was 67 years, Emmanuel Letterman. They had a rabbi there also who was, I can't remember his name now. He was a rabbi for like 50 years, rabbi at that shul in Denver. Someone wrote a doctoral dissertation on him. And Rabbi Hartman says the OU spoke multiple times to Denver regarding Mechitza. It was great pressure. At the end of the day, the people don't want it. So what can you do? Rabbi Kelman, I know of two shuls in Toronto that separately from Mechitza, I believe one into the early 60s and the other into the 21st century. And I personally heard Rav Shachter say that Minat Torah, that was fine. Rav Soloveitchik was explicit that everything he said was about mixed seating, not separate seating. So separate seating, like what does that mean? So if you're right next to each other, then you can have mixing. But if you're far away from each other, that itself would be Mechitza. So it's a different level. When the women were in a gallery, that there's no machitza per se, but you can't get to them. So machitza, the whole idea of machitza is a modern thing. We use machitza synonymously, but old shuls in Europe didn't have machitzas generally. What they had was galleries. The women were in the galleries. Sometimes you had a machitza, like in the Prague shul, not the original Altneu shul. If you've been there, you know there's the women's section, but that's not part of the original building. It was later added. But most shuls did not have mechitzas, and in Hungary, for instance, they had to have lattice work, so you couldn't see the women at all. In other places, it was fine. But then they brought the women down, and the question, once you bring them down, Does that mean they can just sit right next to them? No. So they said you need a machitza, you need a separation, which accomplishes the same thing as the gallery. But and we assume that's only in the shul, not at the minyan. So like a shiva minyan, we don't assume this. Yes, Professor Schmelzer is alive too. Someone privately sends it, but I don't know. I couldn't tell whether he was in that picture. Rabbi Green says the Beit Midrash at JTS had bookcases arranged to act as mechitzas for daily minyan. I remember that even when I went, I used to go there sometimes to the library, but they were all mechitzas. Someone privately says that Dohani, he wrote Dohini, that's in Los Angeles, I think a street, it's Dohani synagogue in Budapest, had or perhaps even has separate seating with no mechitza. I assume someone has visited during services recently. What Dohani has, and we have people here who've been with us, is that until World War II, they had the women always in the gallery. After World War II, they took the women down from the gallery, and to this day, the women and men sit separately on Shabbos. Just like an Unterberg, they don't sit together, women on both sides, men in the middle, except for on the high holidays where the women go back up into the gallery. There's two galleries, double galleries. And Michael says the synagogue in Kingston, Ontario had separate seating, no machitza, at least into the 80s. And Mel says the Orthodox Hebrew Institute shul in White Plains had separate seating, no machitza for decades into the late 60s. Yeah, you had shuls like that, but it wasn't most of these, many of these shuls had separate seating as well as mixed seating. And most of these shuls, we speak of traditional shuls, were complete mixed seating. They called it family seating. The family that prays together stays together. Of course, you could pray together, but not be sitting next to each other. But Susanna says there are some conservative synagogues at stake. They want women to wear tallit and kippah, but doesn't necessarily happen. Whatever happened to freedom of choice and whatever happened to feminism? Isn't feminism about doing what the woman could do what she wants to do? That means if the woman comes to show, if she doesn't want to wear the kippah because she doesn't feel comfortable, you'd think that would be what the conservative movement would argue. But thank you for that, Susanna. Rabbi Shudnow says Yerushalmi equals Palestinian Talmud. The Jews are the true Palestinians. Well, that's the Palestinian Talmud. Yes, I told you what happened. I'll repeat it again for the people who weren't here last semester. There was an image going around a couple months ago of the Palestinian soccer team. So one of this, the Hadid, the model girls, got it, and she tweeted it out to everyone. You see, we do have a history. We had a Palestinian soccer team. Well, had she looked closer, she would have seen that the Palestinian soccer players all had a Jewish star on their shirts. And if you knew anything about it, you knew that every single player on the Palestinian soccer team was Jewish, because there was also something called the Palestine Post. Yeah. Yes, Baruch says a good Easter bunny never died out. It still exists today. Yes, it's still technically on paper. It still exists. Kaplan was a problem as he ended up destroying or weakening the future of conservative rabbi's faith in a personal or any guy. Yes, we'll talk about Kaplan a little next class. William DeWertz, Davar invited Beinart for a Shabbat and it caused violent reaction. Beinart spoke at one of the Jewish schools, but that was high schools near here, but that was about 7-8 years ago when many people didn't know his views then. It's different though, Bill. I mean, invite to a shul is different. Davar is not really a shul, but you invite to a shul. We don't like giving imprimaturs at shuls if we don't think that the person is someone we look up to. But in academic, it's totally different. Now, Davar, I guess they're academic. Regarding Beinart and Baran, you say the issue is it unethical to use medical research done by the Nazis using prisoners? Interesting question. I don't see the problem. I mean, from my own standpoint, if anything could bring some value to the horrible torture they went through, if there's some medical value, I understand that some people don't want to do it, but I don't see it. And Rabbi Green says that Rabbi Elliot Dorf has also written about the driving tshuva. I don't know about that. Did he write also negative that it was a mistake? I think it was a mistake. I think all conservative rabbis pretty much today, I mean, from the elders, the chachamim, understand that it was a mistake. And some of them have written, Gordas himself wrote, we could have gone the Chabad route of just not telling people it's permissible. They thought that by making it easier, you'd bring people in. It turns out that people are not attracted to religion if you make it easier. Keep the standards, and then people have something to look up to and something to strive for. Chabad has shown how you can do that. No, I'm not referring to Baruch Stanley Wagner. His name began with a K. He was a rabbi for many, many years, decades, in Denver. And finally, the last Rabbi Shugnow again. Rabbi Frankis continued to preserve the places of Lieberman, Finkelstein, Zucker, etc. in the library show with an Orthodox sitter. Okay. Well, I thank you all. It's getting good now. The big controversy is coming. Wait till you hear what I discovered in the Yeshiva University archives. One of the great, my great discoveries, Lieberman's letter to the Agudas Rabbanim defending himself. That's got to go down as one of my top 10 discoveries, which is, of course, quoted everywhere now. And I thank those who always give me credit, but I found it in the archive of Rav David Lifshitz. I'll tell you the whole story next class, Meretz Hashem. Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. Okay, we look forward. Always put, you know, the preview for next week. In the interim, we hope to learn with you and to invite your friends to come tomorrow, 11 a.m. Eastern. Rachel Sharansky-Danziger is continuing her series on human relations in Genesis. Wednesday, I mentioned earlier, 1:15 p.m. 1:15 p.m., Rav Yosef Carmel Shiur B'Ivrit. Rav Carmel, the Rosh Kol of Eretz Chemda, I encourage those who understand Hebrew well, or even, you know, relatively well. The Gamma's Hebrew, like I said, is not, he speaks clearly, and it's not a difficult Hebrew to understand. And then Thursday, Shuli Mishkin, her continuing her series on Israel, the medieval period. And Thursday night, Shoshana Shechter will be giving the Parsha Shir. I'll be giving this the Shir on the Siddur Friday morning. And we look forward to learning with everybody. And everybody have a wonderful week. And thank you, everybody. Okay, Laila Tov. And thank you very much. By the way, I will mention Rabbi Bleich does have a tshuva about using Nazi contemporary halachic problems, about using results of Nazi experiments. And from what I recall, he allows it. He, like you say, if we can, why should somebody else have to die just because of the horrendous ways they did the research? So anyways, you can make that as you like, but figure that out that in. Okay, everybody. Have a wonderful night, and we look forward to learning with you. And again, if you're interested, like Dr. Mark said, in joining us on the Morocco trip, first week in January, I encourage you to come. It really is a wonderful trip, and please God, everything will be well, and it can be meaningful and a enjoyable trip and a trip of great learning. So anyway, okay, everybody be well. Laila Tov. Thank you very much.